Did you, you said you went in to the bench from Bullhauser.
Right.
Did you end up, did you, were you a partner in
Yeah, I was a partner at Bullhauser. See, I went back in 1981. I became a partner about 80, maybe 83 or something like that, around there. Very good, very good firm, good, you know, good years. A lot of the, well, this isn't really on point, I guess, but a lot of the lawyers, strangely, from Bullhauser in that era have gone to the bench. You know, like Bob Bowman, who's our Chief Justice, was there with me at Bullhauser, and Vicky Gray and Jane Darty and Laurel Russell, Marvin Koenigsberg. They're all people I worked with at Bullhauser now on the court.
What's the process there? How are you? Who selects you? Or is there a vote?
You mean to become
To become a judge?
Well, the to become a judge, it's an appointment by the cabinet in Ottawa, and it's changed over the years. I mean, going back many years, it used to just be sort of word of mouth, and there'd be a call from the Minister of Justice to somebody, and they'd say, do you want to be appointed to the bench? And they'd say yes or no. And there are all these stories about Lloyd McKenzie, who's now dead, but Lloyd was called in Victoria by the ministry, said, would you accept an appointment if you were asked to be a judge? And he said, well, do you mind if I check with my partners? And check with his partners, and he called back, and he said, yes, if I'm offered, I'll accept an appointment. And he said, and then he said, 4 years later, they called me and offered me a job. So, but anyhow, there's the system, as you probably know from reading the papers, it's now a system where you make an application. There's a committee that vets applicants. It's a committee made up of lawyers, judges, lay people from various walks of life. And that committee, although it changes over time, that committee decides whether you're qualified, not qualified, and then if you're considered by that committee not qualified, then your application, by matter of tradition, doesn't go any further. If you are qualified, then you're in a group that might be appointed, but the decision whether to appoint is a decision for the government. So, and how they do it is their business.
John, if I could just back us up to your time at Bullhauser,
yeah,
in the 80s. Could you just talk a little bit about Bullhauser as a law firm and the practice of law? Then was how many lawyers? What was the support staff? Was it a large firm or a small firm in comparison to other firms? What types of clients did it have? Did you have affiliations with other firms? What was the nature of the larger practice of law in the 80s?
In the 80s through to 94, Bullhauser would be considered a large firm in Vancouver, but not the largest. It might have at that time probably not a great deal of difference in terms of numbers, because the firms have sort of seemed to have peaked and don't seem to be much bigger than 100 or 150, but Bullhauser was about 100. And a bigger firm might, the biggest firm might be 20 lawyers, more than that. So that's sort of the size of the firm. Bullhauser was essentially a firm with quite a number of institutional clients. The Royal Bank was a big client in those days, both in terms of the solicitor's work and in terms of the litigation. It was an era when there was a lot of ups and downs in the economy, so there'd be a lot of receivership related work, that sort of thing. I mean, that sort of went through it's sort of a kind of work you just don't really see that much in the courts or in practice anymore to the same degree. They had a big insurance practice, a big maritime practice, you know, a lot of very solid commercial clients, London Drugs, you know, H.Y. Louis, just trying to think of a few.
Mostly BC-based
Mostly BC-based, yeah. And in terms of a connection, you know, some firms during that era became, like McCarthy's, maybe a little bit later, became a national firm. Bullhauser got a national connection. But I don't think that those national connections really worked out as well as people had hoped, because, you know, there isn't the same sort of cross-Canada work that's, I think, done in the States, for example, but maybe I'm wrong. And I think by having a definite connection, a lot of referral work that the firm would have would be cut off. You know, like when you didn't have a connection, you'd get a referral from firm A, B, C, D, and E in Montreal and Toronto, but when you had a connection with one firm, that would sort of limit your referrals just to that connection. So, I mean, I think it turned out to be not as good as people had hoped. The practice of law was becoming more businesslike through that time, through that decade. Much more focus on hours, recording time.
More focused than when you'd started, or your perception of an earlier?
No, more focused than from when I started. Because when I started, I mean, Bullhauser in 74 or 75 or thereabouts was notorious for having kind of the first automated timekeeping system, computer system. I mean, this was a big deal at the time. It's too bad it didn't break and then no one else followed it, right? I mean, it's been the worst thing for the legal profession, I think. So that became, you know, the focus on the bottom line became more important. But that was across the city. I mean, that wasn't just Bullhauser, right? And, you know, if you wanted to, you had to be an efficient money-making firm if you wanted to attract good lawyers, because good lawyers didn't want to work at firms that, you know, weren't making money. So you had to have a happy, good firm, you had to be a profitable firm.
And so the worst thing for the legal profession, could you talk a little bit, so the billing and keeping track of one's time in 6-minute intervals, or is that what you're charging based on?
Yeah, point one is six minutes. I mean, the great thing about going to the bench, everybody will say this goes to the bench. The greatest thing going to the bench is you don't keep a timesheet, right? And I think that the great thing about the practice of law is solving a situation for a deserving client. I mean, that always gave me the biggest thrill. Not, you know, I mean, whether it's a success in a case or resolving a problem in a way that makes their life or their business a little better is rewarding. I mean, that's what it's all about. It's not about putting down, you know, 0.2 for preparing a list of documents and that sort of thing, right? But you've got to do that. Or else it seems you've got to do that, or else you just can't keep track of the work that you've done to be able to be properly remunerated. So as a result, you know, everybody will say this, that the law firms have developed into places where, you know, people are rewarded for their time, but not necessarily for their success. I mean, you can use a crass example. If you had a piece of litigation come in and you're defending it, if you could make a phone call or two and solve that problem, that's what your client would want. But if, on the other hand, you had a piece of litigation that went for 5 years and had enormous discoveries and lots of time spent organizing and collecting documents, that's what your law firm, you know, must want, because that generates the income, right? So so lawyers have been forced, and good lawyers still do it the way they should. They try to solve the problem because good lawyers are busy, and, you know, there's always more work. So if they solve a problem, they're always on to the next problem. They're not looking to pad files and dig up work like that. But you know, it's resulted, I think, in lawyers being doing unproductive work, work that doesn't make them particularly satisfied in the practice of law, and a million other bad things. I mean, there aren't many good things about keeping time, but there, you know, I don't know how. I mean, everybody does it. It's done everywhere in North America, so I'm not sure how you avoid it unless you have a criminal practice or maybe a personal injury practice, or it doesn't matter to you. You run your own shop. Have you heard that from students or other lawyers?
The challenges of keeping time and the way they're keeping time affects their practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my brief time as a practicing lawyer, I certainly felt it. It was not something that I ever had to do before I became a lawyer, and it was something that was jarring and difficult right from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, it never changes. And I mean, firms, I know this is after my time, but I mean, I think firms work at keeping track of time, because most lawyers, I mean, they work hard, they work 10 hours a day, and then they look at their timesheet and they've got 3.2 hours. Well, you know, what happened? It's just that they've been working on things and they haven't noted them. So they have secretaries watching, and they have, you know, systems for keeping track of what files you access, just to sort of give you a jog as to how you spent your time. And I don't know. Somehow it doesn't seem to be what the practice of law should be about. But. So if the law school can do anything about that, major accomplishment.
And Richard had asked about the appointment process to the bench.
Right.
Was that something that you had your eye on for a while before you...
Well, it's sort of funny because, I mean, the answer, truthful answer is yes. But, you know, you sort of don't say that, or you don't push that too hard, because that's not the way it's done, right? And if you do that, it ends up not coming about. So, truthfully, sure, I always wanted to do it when the opportunity came. And you know, I had lunch with the Chief Justice one day, and he said if I was interested, I should put my name in. He would support me. That was sort of what got me actually to do it. But I'd been thinking about it long before that.
And that was Alan McKechnie?
That was Bill Essen.
Bill Essen.
Yeah. Bill Essen was the chief of the Supreme Court, and Alan McKechnie was the chief of the Court of Appeal, or British Columbia, as they say.
We've been asking people we interview what the greatest change was over their career, and you reminded me of it when you talked about timekeeping and billing. Would that be the greatest change, or were there others?
Well, I think the greatest change probably was the Charter of Rights, right? I mean, in terms of the practice of the law generally, I mean, you know, it wouldn't affect commercial cases and commercial litigation and structuring commercial deals, I don't think. But, you know, in a lot of the litigation that's before the court, a lot of it is driven by issues that arise out of the Charter. And, of course, none of that took place. I mean, we had a Bill of Rights that was only once enforced through the Dry Bones case. But the Charter has changed things. I mean, as a judge, I've spent, you know, lengthy time on a number of cases. And when I do criminal cases, the criminal cases invariably involve Charter challenges challenges to the admissibility of evidence based on alleged Charter infringement. So in terms of the change to the complexion of the law generally, not just my practice, but overall, I would say the Charter was the biggest change to the face of the practice.
And so just to build on that a little bit, so there were certainly now issues that come before you that are Charter issues that wouldn't have come before you
right.
before as a judge or even as a practicing lawyer. But did it also change the way in which the legal profession thought about the law about how it imagined what the law does? Or?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think so. I mean, I don't think that some of the issues that arise and the challenges that are brought could, or even in our contemplation or imagination when we were law students without the charter. I mean the things that the challenges or the issues that are advanced, which are very legitimate, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but those just would never have occurred to us were on the radar. I mean, you know, we kind of left law school thinking, you know, maybe the boundaries of what law can do are, you know, it's an expanding thing, but, you know, there were limits. And it was by and large, you know, is this within the rules of the game as we know it? I mean, is this within the rules of society and the accepted doctrines? And we knew that that the law in our careers of our predecessors had changed, you know, maybe 5 or 10% during their careers. I mean, they left law school, they knew a body of law, and that body of law they knew was pretty well, still pretty good when they retired, except it changed a little bit. Well, I think that's the mindset that we went into the practice with. You know, we're going to solve the problems that our clients face, you know, with these tools, but I think that, you know, the toolbox is not just expanded, it's completely exploded what's available. So I think I'm off point a bit here, but
no. I mean, some people point to the Dixon Court as to the trajectory of Chief Brian Justice Dixon himself as sort of reflecting that transition from a pre-charter era to a post-charter era.
Right.
Where a whole set of issues that weren't thought to be justiciable now become something that the courts are concerned with or that the courts have to deal with.
Right, right.
And this is reflecting a significant transformation in how the law is understood and what people think the law can do. And I guess what your answer about the charter being the most important change is a really interesting one. And so I guess the question would be, how is that, right? How did you see that in your work, first as a lawyer and then as a judge?
I never dealt with the charter as a lawyer. I mean, the charter just had its, was it its 30th birthday?
Yes.
82.
Yeah. And, I mean, those first charter cases in the Dixon Court that you talked about, Hunter and Southam and those sort of cases, when was that? Was that about 85, 86? Yeah. So I think the initial people in practice that had a lot of involvement with the charter were the criminal lawyers and using it in, you know, search and seizure, Section 8 issues and that sort of thing. But it was after that where it started to go throughout the practice.
Has it had the Constitution presumably is taught in constitutional law courses here? Has it led to a kind of increase in that? In that side of the profession and the teaching profession, Graham, you probably know what's going on here better than anyone.
Well, I know what I took in Constitution. I don't know. I can't honestly say how it's changed. I mean, charter is pretty well entrenched, and that's one of the bigger things you do in Constitution. So, the way it sort of broke down was we did primarily half-year federalism and a half-year of charter.
Right.
Was the way it was structured. So you dealt with federalism first and then charter. And Aboriginal was sort of sandwiched in between the two, so it sort of segued into charter through that means. But I presume without the charter, it's not going to be there.
Right.
It's certainly not going to, the old Bill of Rights is certainly never going to occupy a half year of your law school.
No, half hour, but half, yeah, that's right. And the, I guess the other big change has been the, you know, Aboriginal issues have seemed to occupy the courts more and more, and seem to be issues that are there in the field that you'll probably have more play than a lot of standard charter issues in the commercial world, right? I mean, the development of the duty to consult and all of that sort of thing and what it means, I mean, I think is an enormous, enormous issue for companies and communities and that sort of thing in British Columbia. So that's a major, significant change since I graduated.
And in your personal career, perhaps the biggest change has been the shift from the practice of law to the bench.
Right.
And to your work as a judge.
Right.
And could you talk a little bit about your work as a judge?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a judge since 94, so I'm, that's 18 years ago. Yeah, I've done a wide variety of things as a judge. Not particularly, we don't specialize on our court. We have some people that have had particular criminal experience that will do the more high-profile criminal cases. Yeah, but I don't have that sort of criminal expertise. So, I mean, I'll do family, commercial, you know, anything that the Superior Court will hear. Being a judge is reminds me of the earlier question of, you know, is there anything I'd rather have studied or courses I've wished I'd taken in law school? The answer is all of them, and studied much more carefully. So every case doesn't sort of start like a, oops, here's another course subject matter I don't know anything about. But that's one of the great things. One of the great things about the law school was the variety. One of the great things about the bench is the variety. You know, some people say, well, gee, why don't we have, you know, four judges that do, you know, succession cases and four judges that do, you know, property cases so we, you know, get some expertise. And the, I think one of the things is that the variety encourages you to keep learning and keep, and you can learn from one area and bring a principle from that area to the other. So the variety has been endless. If you asked me, you know, just to answer quickly without thinking about how long I've been on the bench, I'd say about, you know, 5 or 6 years. So it just flies by. You know, the days are endlessly enjoyable. I mean, the hard part of the work is the writing, you know, writing the judgments and, you know, analyzing, going back through the evidence and making sure you've considered all the cases and, you know, all the arguments. And, you know, that becomes quite a, well, as you know, putting a piece of work together. I mean, it's, you know, when it's done, it always looks so simple. I mean, like, yep. You just start at the beginning and you get to the end and you're done. But, you know, why it says draft 61 on your document, I'm not quite sure. But, so it's endlessly entertaining. The court is a very collegial place. You know, it's hard to think of a better job. You know, I mean, I'm not just saying that as a Pollyanna. It really is a fabulous job. You know, I think one of the great things is that, and then one of the difficult things about the practice of law is the practice of law is quite stressful, and when you get to a mid-career point, a lot of people get sort of near burnout, and they need something to reinvigorate them. Sometimes it's a sabbatical or something, but, you know, a change to go to the bench is really a fabulous thing, and it's too bad that there isn't something like that for everybody in their walk of life, but there isn't, so... you know, I've enjoyed it very much. In the court, I've been involved in judicial education, so I think a little bit about the law school when I do that. I'm involved in the new judges program. There's a new judges program for new judges. All the federally appointed judges in that year get together twice a year, and they're sort of walked through the basics of civil cases, criminal cases. So I'm in charge of the new judges program civil, so we do a day and a half with new judges. So it's great fun because they're all sort of on top of the world. They've just recently received the call. They don't have yet the responsibilities weighing too heavily on their shoulders. They don't have a pile of reserve judgments they're behind on. So anyhow, that's kind of fun. And then I was involved last week in a course on the charter. There's an intensive program. So, you know, judicial education is very important and kind of reminds us of the importance of the law school, I guess.
John, you mentioned when you were a lawyer that what gave you the most satisfaction and what you saw your principal role as a problem solver.
Right.
To help people get to resolve an issue. That's why they'd come to see you.
Right.
How would you characterize your principal role as a judge?
Well, I think much the same way. And they're all issues, disputes, or problems that come before us in one form or another, right? And our question is to resolve and adjudicate that in a fair way. I mean, we can't do it quite the same way that we could as a lawyer. The avenues open to us as a lawyer are much broader, of course, and the options are much broader. But the difference from a lawyer's perspective and a judge's perspective is that, you know, as a lawyer, you're trying to come up with a solution that works for your client. I mean, you're trying to push things a certain way, right? And because you think your client deserves to have the best solution that's available to him or her. And sometimes that's difficult as a lawyer because you're pushing things that sometimes won't necessarily go in that direction, right? The facts don't go that way. Whereas a judge, it doesn't matter to you which way it turns out. I mean, so you don't have that pressure of having to force a conclusion. You just decide the case the way you think it's justly decided. So, it's much easier. There's less of that tension. I'm not sure I'm describing it properly, but you know, I mean, if I was acting for you and you had a problem, I'd be, you know, if there were witnesses, you said, well, I didn't go on my neighbor's property, and I'm thinking, oh, God, how are we going to deal with those five witnesses that said you were there, you know? So, you know, that sort of thing. I said, we won't call them or blah, blah, blah. But as a judge, that's just the way the facts are. So you don't have that tension, and you just try to resolve it as fairly as you can. And so.
Yeah. So maybe another way of asking the same question, and it's not because that wasn't a good answer, it was, but I'm just...
Wasn't that a good answer, but
when you're writing who is that judgment for? Who are you writing the judgment for?
Well, that's something they talk about at judgment writing courses. They say, who's your audience? And I mean, there are different audiences and different parts of judgment sometimes have different audiences in mind. You know, like sometimes you got to be frank that you're writing for the Court of Appeal because the Court of Appeal want to make sure you covered all bases, right? But they say, and I think, and I accept this, that you write for the losing party. The winning party doesn't really care, usually, about the reasons you found for the winning party. The fact that they won is usually enough. But your judgment has to explain fairly and completely to the losing party why they lost. So I think that involves really considering both arguments. So I think the argument... So it has to be addressed mostly to the parties and explaining the emphasis on explaining to the losing party why they're unsuccessful. Now, sometimes when I write a judgment, I have a cousin of mine who's a good friend, who's a professional, but not a lawyer, that I try to imagine that I'd be writing the judgment to him. I mean, he'd be interested in it. I wouldn't have to keep it at a very, very simple level to make it understandable. You know, he's sophisticated, but he's not a lawyer, so I'll have to explain the legal concepts. So if I have an imaginary reader when I'm writing a judgment, it's somebody like that. But that's often something I have in mind when I'm getting to a later stage of a draft of a judgment than when I start off the judgment.
So, go ahead. If I can just follow, so I'm really interested that judges talk about who they're writing for, and that
right.
There's some sense that one's writing for the party that's losing, at least in a way that explains how the decision was reached. But why?
Why do you do that?
Yeah, why feel as though it's necessary to explain to the losing party? A court could simply be a dispute resolution body that comes up with a decision. Why the focus on the explanation to the party that's unsuccessful?
Well, I mean, because I think of to maintain the legitimacy of the institution. I mean, once a judge issues his or her reasons, that's it. You can't go on and say, well, just hang on. You're unhappy with that decision, but let me tell you what I meant. This is why I did it. I didn't believe that person. I didn't believe, or whatever the reasons might be. So this is your one shot. And the legitimacy of the court and why our orders are obeyed and people have confidence coming to us is based on our body of work. I mean, every one of our sets of reasons for judgment, right? And collectively put together and examined by the public. And I think that the most important person who needs to be persuaded that the decision is legitimate is the losing party. And if you're able to say to a person, it's because of these reasons, they may disagree with you, but they'll understand and they'll have some respect for the institution. So I think that's essentially why you do it, to maintain the legitimacy of the institution. Without proper reasons, I don't think you would do that.
You wouldn't have the rule of law.
Yeah. I mean, I think the rule of law isn't just it's my choice, I decide, right? I mean, reasons for judgment are the opposite of arbitrariness, right? And they have to be legitimate reasons for judgment. I mean, you know there are issues in some cases about judges' reasons for judgment and what happens when people say that judges do not properly explain their judgments and the effect that has. But it's interesting. I mean, you know, we talk a fair bit about who we write the judgment for, and different people have different views. I mean, like I said, like it's the public, it's court appeal, you know, it's for your colleagues, blah blah blah. It's for the press, and I mean, I think it's all of. I mean, it's a bit of all of that, but I mean, I think it essentially is the losing party, but a little bit for the press in the sense that. Judges now know that certain cases are picked up, right? And, you know, you write a long judgment and you know you've got to do a summary because the press don't have the time to be able to synthesize it and give it a proper thing. So you know they're going to pick up on your summary and you know that's what's going out. Well, you're not doing that just for PR purposes, but you want the public that read the paper to have as fair a sense of why you decide the case as you can, but that's just an aspect of, you know, justifying it for the losing party, I think.
I can see if you have the losing party in mind, I can see that you might have to have that empathy might be an important part of your job.
Right.
Because otherwise you're... But impartiality, too, and you have to look at both sides have to look at all the evidence.
Right. I mean, it's a particularly significant issue. As a judge, not so much in reasons for judgment, but in dealing with the unrepresented litigant in court, right? I mean, it's a very difficult process for an unrepresented litigant. An unrepresented litigant, you want to show some empathy for their position so they understand that they're getting a fair hearing and you're at least, initially approaching it with an open mind and a sympathetic ear. But on the other hand, we still are caught in an adversarial process, and It's such a difficult balance to maintain in the courtroom because you want to help an unrepresented person present their case properly, but you got some person on the other side who's paying what they see as a small fortune for a lawyer, and you have this judge who's seems to be going over backwards to, you know, help this person, you know, well, why don't you do this, or have you considered calling this witness, or that sort of thing, and that person gets the impression, I mean, what is this? What kind of a bias system is this? Whereas the person who doesn't have the lawyer gets the better shake. So so that's a very difficult, and that's an area where nowadays is the most difficult for judges, where judges get into the most trouble, where there are the most complaints by lay litigants usually about the way they've been treated. So I just started to make those comments when you talked about empathy, and empathy is an important thing, but it's a two-edged sword when there's two sides in a court case.
Mm-hmm. I was also going to ask about Aboriginal issues. You said they were one, that was one of the big changes. Why is that?
God. Well, it's, you know, I don't think it's necessarily connected with the charter, but, you know, as they talk about the charter era, I mean, it's kind of thinking that the charter has created in people, thinking that they can and should assert their rights, or maybe it's simply that a lot of these claims have you know, a lot of them are not necessarily new. They've been around for a long time and have, you know, been suppressed in different ways. So part of why Aboriginal law is a big part now, you know, recognition through some of the cases that these cases are provable. Supreme Court of Canada's body of jurisprudence on that. You know, part of it is just the attitude of people in the charter era that, you know, the courts will recognize and enforce their rights. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of people in Aboriginal communities that are, you know, want to... Why do they want to assert their rights? Well, part of it is, I mean, it comes back to the law school here in part. I mean, the law school has been graduating Aboriginal law students for, 20 years now at least?
Well, Alfred Scow was the first in
61.
He graduated in 61.
Yeah.
But so there's been the First Nations Legal Studies program since the early 1970s.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's got to have an effect over time and people articulating and advancing their rights. So, there probably are historical reasons that I'm just not particularly alive to, but a combination of all of those things, you know, development in areas of the province where there previously hadn't been development, where there are, it crosses Aboriginal claims.
John, I might bring you back to the law school in the 2000s. I'm not exactly sure when, but you became the president of the Law Alumni Association.
Yes.
And wondering what precipitated that, what got you back involved in a direct way in the law school again?
I'm trying to remember. I got involved on the board maybe a year or so before Dean Babinski joined the law school. I don't really recall the reason. I mean, the board... The Alumni Association didn't seem to be doing all that much, really. I always thought it was an important organization. I always thought the connection between the law school and the profession wasn't as strong as it should have been, I thought, to the detriment of the profession and to the detriment of the law school. And I had seen in many places like Toronto and places in the United States where people sort of identified themselves as a badge of honor. I'm a graduate of University of Michigan Law School. I mean, this was a big thing. And I think the law school was suffering a little bit under the fact that the building was such a problem for the law school's reputation that, you know, everything seemed to be, oh, but the building, you know, you got that. So anyhow, so I got involved, and then there became a time when the president was thinking of stepping down. I was asked if I would run for to be president, and I thought, sure, yeah, I'll try this. And then it was really a lot of fun, and I mean, we got great cooperation from and support from the law school, from the Dean Binsky, Robin Elliott, Yost was on the board, and I mean, the board was just a very lively bunch of people. We started to try to do some different things, like you know, have some dinners and to recognize some of our alumni that deserve recognition because of what they'd accomplished, and you know, have some speakers and get everybody together just to get that community. So I mean, it just struck me as it struck me that it is such a part of who we are that we graduate from this law school. I mean, none of us would have the identity that we have if we hadn't gone to UBC Law School. I mean, I would be a different person. All my friends would be different people. All the people I see every day on the bench, you know, most of them are UBC Law graduates. They would be different people. And yet, this common bond that we have that's so critical to our identity, you know, people just sort of seem to be brushing off as being insignificant. And yet, kind of when you get people together and they recognize it, it's sort of people will see how important it is, so anyhow, that intrigued me. I liked working with the people who had that common view, and you know, with great support of the law school, we put a few events together that sort of reinforced people's you know, kind of collective self-esteem, and so it just struck me as a good thing. I mean, I'm a great believer that a society has to have solid institutions. Like, they have to be, you have to have solid schools, and you have to have solid banks, and, you know, universities, and on and on. And so when you have a good institution, you should foster it. So that was really the interest. Yeah.
We looked at your at the CD that you did.
Right.
On the
50th anniversary. Yeah. 50th anniversary.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how did that come about?
well, that's sort of Lynn Smith, then the dean, either organized a committee or there was a committee to do something to celebrate the event at the dinner. And so we had a committee and we talked about some stuff. We talked about this and talked about that and weren't really coming up with any ideas. And then we decided, I think somebody had talked about doing a video at the medical school or something for their anniversary of their school. So anyhow, so I remember that we were in the East in Prince Edward Island, and I was trying to come up with an idea. So I was sitting there, and I came up with this idea of it's a pretty stale idea, but the law student who never graduated was there all along. So, and then we would sort of build a story around that. So we got a budget, and we had, I spoke to Tom Shorthouse, who was the librarian, and Tom and I went way back because Tom's wife, who won't admit to this, was my very first teacher in grade 7 when I came out from Ontario. There she was. And I think it was her first teaching assignment in any event. So Tom, you know, Tom's one of those guys where you say, can you help? And next thing you know, he says, well, here's five songs I've written. So he'd written some music, and we got a camera crew and got some people together, and Murray Tevlin and I wrote kind of a script, and then we sort of put it together. Peter Butler, who was of this notorious class of 1956, agreed to be the 50-year man. And then we just got people that had different roles at the law school at different times, George Curtis and Bertie McLean and Peter Burns and Lynn, and Ken Lessig was away, but we got him later, and then a bunch of students at different times and a bunch of props, and just kind of put this thing together with the help of a guy named Al Vitols, V-I-T-O-L-S, who was a former CBC guy who taught us about editing and all that kind of stuff, and we put it together. And then, and I think I was telling you when we were looking at it, we thought that the ticket sales were kind of poor, so we would put references to people we knew bought tickets. Like we'd say, oh, Joe Thompson, you know, did such and such. They were totally obscure names, but we knew they'd bought a ticket. But as it turned out, the place was packed. There were about 800 or 900 people there, and the video was a big success. So that was that. And then there was a campaign. I think the campaign was for the chair of the women's studies, and so they needed a briefer video, so we edited it down sort of to a 10-minute fundraiser one. That's the shorter of the two. Added a few things, and the videos are interesting because, and if you look through them again, I think most of the history is sort of accurate, because, you know, Bertie McLean and George Curtis and Lynn and Peter Burns all knew the history and they contributed to it. So although a lot of it is kind of goofy, a lot of the facts are accurate about the history of law school. So that was that.
Thank you. I jotted down a few notes when you were talking. You mentioned the importance of the graduates and the importance of the law school, and I thought maybe the word you were looking for was community. That was
right.
An important thing too. And you also said you have stayed in touch with other law school graduates. But how important was it? Is it really just a small community of you and your contemporaries and other graduates?
I don't think it's. I think in this day and age, a lot of people foster connections that are useful to them for financial reasons. I don't really think you could say that, you know, the connection has any significant benefit in that respect. I think it's just a part of who you are, and a sense of belonging to a community, having a good law school. When the dean put the fund together to raise money for the law school, I think that was a very rewarding thing for the people that contributed, to be part of that community. That's a very good thing. I don't think it does them, a great deal of good financially, but it's some intangible that's important to the way our society works. So I don't know. I'm sure there are benefits of community that people could go on about, but I'm not sure I understand them entirely. But
John, you're in a somewhat unique position in that you were here as a student in the 70s, and then you've never been an insider again in the sense of being a faculty member.
Right.
But you've been very connected to this place.
Almost a faculty member. I was an adjunct, signed up to do the civil procedure course, and before my first lecture, I was appointed to the bench.
Okay.
So that's close.
That's close.
Yeah, okay.
But you had a strong relationship to this place, through a group of classmates who worked professionally together, of
right.
course, through your marriage to Lynn, who would become dean.
Right.
And then a daughter who would come here as a student.
Right.
And then
a
sister who was here as a student. And then,
right.
And then as president of the Law Alumni. So you've seen this place in a whole number of different roles.
Right. Can I add one, and then one footnote just to get in there? One connection to the law school that I think is quite strong is the fact that When Lynn was the dean, I would accompany her to social functions where Bill Essen as Chief Justice and Alan McEachern as Chief Justice would often go, so we would often be at the same table. And Alan McEachern was an enormous supporter of the law school, right? And Bill Essen was as well.
And the university more generally.
Yeah, and the university more generally. So I think that, you know, Bill and Alan McEachern were great storytellers, and Alan McEachern would always talk about, you know, there's that, he'd always have wonderful stories. Like he told the story, and I'll just tell this one for the record for what use it is, but I'll get back to Kristen. Like Alan McEachern told the story about George Curtis, about George, and Alan would always have tons of these, so this would kind of reinforce the connection with the law school. But the story was that when the first class was established after the war, you didn't have to have a university degree to get enrolled. If you were a veteran, I think if you had a high school degree, you could come in. At least that's the way the story was told. So anyhow, so this fellow was in the class, and he did first year, and then was in second year, and he was married. And in his second year, he separated from his wife, which made his wife very unhappy. And she reported to Dean Curtis, or her father reported to Dean Curtis, that her now ex-husband, who was a student in second year, had represented to the law school that he had a high school degree, when in fact he didn't have a high school degree, right? So George Curtis called this student in and said, Mr. Such and Such, it's been reported to me that you represented that you had a high school degree and you don't. Is that true? And the student said, yes, that's true. And George said, well, don't do it again. So Alan McEachern would tell these stories. He had a million of them. So I guess I just wanted to, I'm trying to remember why I have such a strong connection. But I mean, telling stories like that, and he'd have a million of them, would reinforce the connection with the law school.
Yeah. And so with all of these connections, but as an outsider, wondering if you could just reflect on your perception of this place, of its changes, of how it's transformed as a law school and as an important part of the legal education process in BC.
Well, I mean, it's always been a critical, important part of the legal process in BC, because most of the lawyers come from here, right, in British Columbia. I think as an outsider, I always thought that it suffered, as I said, badly because of the building and the reputation that the building gave it. I think in the last, I got to be careful because I've got a biased view. I mean, I think my wife did a wonderful job even as an outsider. But I think she and Yost were stifled by the building. But my impression is that in the last, 15 years, particularly with the new building, the law school is just absolutely going towards the top. I mean, the hirings, to my knowledge, have been fabulous. The buzz downtown is nothing but good about the law school and the building and how great a thing that is for the law school. So I think that from my perspective, the only problem that the law school had was the building, and that's behind the law school now. I'm not sure whether I know different people have different views about, why don't we have more sort of standard commercial people or something, And I think that's all tied in with sort of a feeling of being second-class citizens because of a poor building, and some place like U of T because it's old and established and has someone connected with that's a better thing. I mean, I think that's all disappearing with the change in the the building. So I think that, so I can't overestimate the importance of a new building, I guess. Am I starting to answer your question?
Yeah. Interesting that the physical space might be so transformative.
You wouldn't think so. And it's funny, you know, because, you know, if you go to England, you know, some of the most magnificent things you expect to see are done in dingy little quarters, you know, and it's sort of, yet they have an enormous world reputation. And if I can tell one more story, this is one Louise Mandel tells all the time when she, you know, when they were repatriating the Canadian Charter and Canadian Constitution. And so they had the House of Lords struck a committee, and the committee was to discuss and report to the House on the bill to repatriate the Constitution. And so some of Louise's clients, and I mean, Louise Mandel is a graduate from UBC, as you may know, a fabulous lawyer. She was asked by some of her clients, well, is there something that we can do to prevent this from happening? And, you know, Louise, no challenge is without a solution. So Louise said, well, sure, we can go over to England and make representations to the committee, right? So she gets her clients together, which are a bunch of chiefs, and over they go. And, of course, you'd expect them to go into some great hall for this meeting, but, of course, it's kind of a dingy back room where this lord is having his meetings, and they all walk, and the lord says to Louise's clients, where are you from? And he said, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And he says, oh, I thought they spoke English, he said. Louise tells that story. I don't, you can find out from her whether it's true. So anyhow, I have to go pretty soon. You probably almost finished with me, but I'm always happy to do anything else. So.
Well, I think we are, but I always ask Graham, who's often got a...
everything I had written down, somebody already got to...
So do you have some names? Do you want some names of people to interview that might be useful? Or
that would be useful. Yeah. Well, you already said it.
I gave you a couple, but... I mean, Louise Mandel is a very important person to interview because of her... I mean, you know, Louise has been one of the most significant, if not the most significant, lawyers to come out of the law school, given her path in the development of Aboriginal issues. So that's a very, very interesting to see her perspective, I'm sure. I mean, Lynn, you should do, because Lynn, you get the facts straight from Lynn. You can correct all the stuff that I've said. Birdie, of course, you know, Birdie and Peter Burns, of course, and Yost.
Yeah.
Michael O'Keefe, I think Michael O'Keefe is a very good one because Michael is a little bit older and will capture that era. You know, the trouble with guys like Bill, you know, Bill might be getting a little forgetful, but if Bill Essen has got a good day, I mean, he'd be a great source. And yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
So is this any use to you guys?
It's
terrific.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's great help. Okay,